Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and I have the real pleasure to talk to two of the authors of the very new book, Deep Roots, How Slavery Still Shapes Southern Politics. The book is published by Princeton University Press, and I have Matthew Blackwell and Maya Sen here today to talk about the book. Matt, you're there?
Yep. Hi, I'm here.
Good. And Maya, you are as well. Matt, maybe you'd like to start and just introduce yourself and also your other co-author, Avedit, who isn't with us today. And then Maya, then you can do the same.
Sure.
Yeah. So my name is Matt Blackwell. I'm an assistant professor of government at Harvard University. I study statistical methods and also American politics. This slavery book is a big part of that. And then our third co-author who's not here is Avi Acharya, who's an assistant professor at Stanford University.
Great. And Maya, how about yourself?
Sure. My name is Maya. I am an associate professor of public policy at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. My research is focusing on American politics with a special focus on race and ethnic politics and also judicial politics. I do a lot of work that uses the methodologies of political economy to look at inequalities in American politics.
Yeah, the methods background shows up so much in this book. It's such an interesting and deeply researched book. It also has a beautiful cover. If there is a contest for amazing academic book covers, of which many are not as nearly as beautiful or creative, this is one. So go out and take a look at the book cover. I have this theory that I'm working on that you can judge the quality of a book by the number of people thanked in the acknowledgement section. And using this theory, your book is going to be a bestseller. You thank a lot of people.
I hope you're right.
Matt, I wonder, maybe you can just start us off by talking a little bit. You don't have to talk about all those people that you thank that's in the book, but talk a little bit about how the three of you came together to write this book. And how did this all work?
Yeah, sure. So the three of us, before we were in our current positions, we were all on faculty at the University of Rochester in the Department of Political Science. And, you know, when we were there, there was a great kind of group of junior faculty who were all getting together on a regular basis and talking about work and talking about research and the different ideas that we had. And I think And also just about kind of what's going on in American politics at any given time. And I think me, Avi, and Maya all really hit it off and really were kind of felt, it came to a realization that we kind of felt like American politics subfield was really, really focused on things that were contemporary. You know, so what is the effect of a political mailer on someone's propensity to vote or something like that, which are all important questions. And we find that research really fascinating. But we were kind of, you know, we noticed that those things were relatively small, had relatively small impacts. And we thought that, you know, but we know that people have deeply held beliefs and there's these big differences between different regions of the country. And like, where could that come from? Where do the big differences come from? And I think we kind of started to think about, well, maybe it's the history of the United States that has kind of led us to some of the political cultures that we see across the country, so ingrained. I think that was the beginning seed. It was trying to figure out, you know, how did we get to the place where we are today?
Now, Maya, you start the book by comparing two southern cities, Greenwood, Mississippi, and Asheville, North Carolina. I wonder if you could describe, you know, each of these places and how the comparison between them really sets up one of the central questions of the book.
Yeah, so we chose those two cities in part because they really illustrate, I think, quite well the puzzle that we address in the book, which is that one of those places, Greenwood, Mississippi, it's actually located in the Southern Black Belt. And the people who live there tend to be very conservative. And I'm actually speaking specifically about the whites who live there. Greenwood is actually a majority Black city. So the whites who live there are actually fairly conservative. If you look at a place like Asheville, North Carolina, despite the fact that for portions of their history, they might have looked similar. We can talk for a second about ways in which they ended up not looking similar. But Asheville is actually fairly progressive by Southern standards. So whites who live in Asheville are actually fairly liberal by Southern standards. Now, that sets up sort of the puzzle in the book, which is what explains kind of this divergence. What makes whites who live in places like Greenwood, Mississippi, more conservative? And what makes whites who live in Asheville, North Carolina, and other cities like it across the South comparatively more liberal? Now, I said they had some similarities in their history. They had some prominent differences. And the prominent difference that we focus on in the book is the fact that places like Greenwood that were located in the Southern Black Belt. So by Black Belt, we basically just mean kind of this hook-shaped area that extends from the Mississippi Delta through Mississippi, Alabama, into Georgia and South Carolina. Greenwood, like many other places in that Black Belt, had a very, very strong tradition of slavery. So going back to its founding, its economy really revolved around the institution of slavery. And in Greenwood specifically, it was about the cultivation of cotton. And Greenwood is known as sort of the cotton capital of the United States. It was a huge driving force in the development of the city. Asheville is really different. Asheville is more in the kind of more mountainous, more temporarily cool. It never really had the kind of terrain that was well suited for large scale agriculture, such as cotton or tobacco. And so its economy just moved in a very, very different direction. It never had a high prevalence of slavery the way that Greenwood did. That is all to say that these two cities sort of illustrate kind of different paths at different places across the South kind of experienced. Some places were more like Greenwood and really relied extensively on the institution of slavery, and other places were more like Asheville and did not, and developed kind of other industries and moved in a different direction. And we think that that helps explain some of the differences in political culture that we see today. So we think those juxtaposing those two cities, which is what we do in the introduction of the book, kind of sets up basically the explanation that the rest of the book then seeks to provide about why these places differed in terms of their political geography, their political culture.
Yeah. And Matt, I think that for a lot of people, this question, what has interested you, many people would share it, but they wouldn't have the clear argument for what links the past and the present together. I wonder if you could briefly describe the mechanism that you three are arguing for that connects the practice of slavery in the past to the politics of today.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think part of this is the practice of slavery, and a lot of it is the kind of the demise of slavery in the South, kind of in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War. And kind of what we argue in the book is that the economic structures that have been in place in the South, in these areas where slavery had been so prevalent, was so important to the Southern planters, the Southern white planters, that when slavery was abolished, they really sought to recreate that economic system using kind of more localized and sometimes more informal modes of oppression that had some similar consequences. And this was incredibly racialized, but it was a slight difference than before the Civil War, when there was slavery, when slavery was kind of a state level or even a region level endeavor. A lot of the stuff that we see that's happening in the postbellum period, we see things become more localized. So the enforcement of certain kinds of black codes, which were a series of laws that were designed to prevent black people in the South from full economic and social mobility, were enforced a lot of times at the local level. A lot of the greatest support for Jim Crow laws came from the Southern Black Belt, whereas people in the upcountry, the areas that had relatively fewer slaves, were very deeply skeptical of some of these changes, these kind of the Jim Crow era laws and state constitutions that had the effect of disenfranchising black voters. And so this kind of the series of kind of informal and formal oppressive systems that kind of came up in response to the demise of slavery kind of after Reconstruction ended are really, I think, the link between the economic system of slavery in the 19th century into the kind of Jim Crow, localized Jim Crow era in the 20th century. And by that time, we're talking about people that are still around today. So people that were born, say, before the white primary was ended in the 1940s, all of those people are still alive today, and obviously have kids and grandkids that that may live in the area. So I think, you know, part of this is the idea that there was economic incentives that people were responding to in the late 19th and early 20th century to repress African-Americans in the South. And then another part of it is that even after those incentives were kind of more or less demolished by mechanization of slavery, or sorry, mechanization of the cotton industry, and by changes to the federal legislation, the persistence comes from the kind of parent-to-child transmission of beliefs that we can kind of detect in racial attitudes over the course of the 20th century.
So the idea is that over time, that families pass down these beliefs, and it doesn't just go away over a short period of time.
Yeah. Can I give actually an example of that I found really persuasive? So in the course of writing the book, one of the real treats for us was to engage pretty deeply in the work of historians and sociologists, which sometimes is quantitative political scientists. I think we don't do enough of. But in our case, I think there were some really rich memoirs and historical narratives that really illustrated this pathway that Matt just described. One of the ones that I found really shocking and surprising was the extent to which children were actually incorporated into the rituals of racial violence in the South through the early 20th century. And this is, like Matt said, this is not something that was so far back in our past. In fact, this extended into the 30s and 40s. There's an example that we discuss in the book of a lynching that happened in 1935, which is, again, not that long ago, where the person who was lynched, this is in Fort Lauderdale in Florida, a person was lynched, and as part of the lynching, the community actually incorporated children, local white children, to watch and observe. And there are several photographs of this particular lynching where they're very graphic. You can see sort of the body dangling from a tree, which is, you know, obviously a jarring image in and of itself. But in the background, just below the feet, you can actually see several children kind of standing there smiling. As if this was part of kind of like a holiday, like kind of a day off from school that they got to celebrate and participate in this. The children in that picture, actually, they look like they're about 4 or 5. So that would make them, you know, sort of in like maybe their mid-80s. So it's quite likely, as Matt said, that they're actually still alive. And if they themselves are not alive, then it's very, very likely that they have children and grandchildren who are still alive who maybe heard these stories. And it's really hard to think that that wouldn't deeply affect the people involved and shape how people thought about kind of a racial hierarchy and race and race relations.
Yeah. You mentioned the book also, even something simple as children's stories reflecting some of these beliefs. Now, Maya, I wonder if you could continue. Now, while you do use these other sources, much of the book is relying on quantitative analysis. And, you know, even I think for the person who said, you know, I understand that the past matters, but there's so many other things that must get in the way that the direct connection you couldn't possibly find statistically, but that's what you go about doing in the book. And in chapter 3, you take on one of the big questions in the book, which is whether areas with high concentrations of slavery in the 1800s have predictable politics today. I wonder if you could describe for us what you found about ideology and particular policy positions as they relate to practices of the past.
Yeah, sure. So this really speaks to, I think, the core findings of the book. And once we discovered these basic relationships, we knew there was a deeper story there that we had to explore and we had to dig into. So just to give you a sense of what we found using the quantitative data. So first we looked at slavery in 1860, which is basically just on the cusp of the Civil War. And this is the 1860 U.S. Census. So it's the last census taken before slavery is dismantled by the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. So we look at the relationship between slavery in 1860 as captured by that U.S. Census, and we see how it predicts political attitudes today. And that we have several findings in this, so I'll just kind of describe just a few of them to give you a flavor of this. So for example, we see that slavery in 1860, slavery in 1860, obviously no slaves today, so it's historical, actually predicts positively a white person's party affiliation. So let me rephrase that to make that a little bit more clear. So a white person living in an area that had a high prevalence of slavery in the historical period, 1860s, is today more likely to identify as a Republican. In addition, so that's just sort of on partisanship. In addition, a white person living in a place that had a high prevalence of slavery in 1860 is more likely to oppose affirmative action or policies that we would describe as affirmative action policies. That person's also more likely to express sentiments that political scientists would describe as racially resentful. That person is also more likely to express cooler feelings in general toward African Americans as opposed to whites. Interestingly, we started digging into this quite deeply because we were kind of interested as to whether this was just sort of an overall more conservative leaning or whether this was something specific about race and racial attitudes. So interestingly, we do not find that a white person living in areas that historically had a high prevalence of slavery are more conservative on non-race related policy issues. So we do not find that they're more skeptical about climate change, for example. And we do not find that they're less inclined to agree strongly with reproductive rights for women or to oppose same-sex marriage. We do not find differences on those sorts of issues. Where we find these differences and where slavery really has sort of a predictive impact and we think a causal impact is when it comes to things that have a strong connection to racial attitudes. So race-related policy positions, ideological positions, and partisanship is where we find the real striking findings.
Yeah, it's just amazing. Sorry to interrupt, but the differences that you find and the fact that they hold, even when you're comparing to other conservative positions, I think are just so incredible. And in the book, I imagine because of that, you also address some of the counter explanations to some of these findings. And in chapter 5, you describe the antebellum folkways hypothesis. I wonder if maybe you guys could just describe that hypothesis and what you did to discover or to either refute or support this hypothesis and how you dealt with sort of the other competing explanations for the very, very interesting and sort of shocking findings in that analysis, Maya, that you just described.
When we first found that simple relationship, I think we knew that we had something that we needed to explore, and we needed to figure out why we were seeing the fact that slavery in 1860 was predictive of people's attitudes today. And so we immediately started thinking of explanations. You know, one possibility is the one that we ultimately came around to thinking, which is that we think that slavery played a big role in this. And slavery actually changed people's attitudes and has had a persistent impact. That's actually what we think. But we really had to engage with these other possible explanations. And the first one that I think came to people's minds, and certainly was something that we thought about, was this idea that maybe what we're picking up is just the fact that places that developed and came to rely extensively on the institution of slavery, those were simply places where people had pre-existing attitudes about a racial hierarchy and had racial attitudes that were then carried on, right? So this isn't something that sort of developed around the time of the years leading up to the Civil War and was exacerbated by its collapse. This is something that has always existed. And this is consistent with arguments that have been made about where people came from in England and Scotland and where they settled and attitudes that they carried with them. And so this is why we call this the antebellum folkways hypothesis, this idea that we're just picking up something that predated the institution of slavery. And in fact, maybe these attitudes actually determined which places came to rely extensively on the institution of slavery. So we actually did a fair number of analyses and historical research to try to figure out if this argument was really what was explaining what was going on. And ultimately, we found this argument to not really be helpful in terms of explaining regional differences today, in part because, and this is something that historical records are very, very consistent about, because racism was actually fairly uniform across the entire country. In the years before the Civil War. there was not much disagreement about the institution of slavery at a state or even regional level. Places that were not reliant on slavery were supportive of the institution. White people who did not themselves hold slaves were supportive of the institution, I think in large part because slaveholding was a path to wealth accumulation. So if you, as a white person, did not hold slaves yourself, you actually supported the institution because you saw it as a way for you to get wealthy. So you aspire to that. One of the ways that I understand it, one of the most useful analogies, is it's sort of the way that we view home ownership today. It's like a path, sort of a natural path to wealth. I think that's a persuasive analogy to the way that white people living in the South saw slavery in the antebellum period. It was a pathway to wealth and a way to get rich. And so even if you didn't hold slaves yourself, you actually supported the institution because it was economically a path, an upward mobility path. So we actually don't see the political cleavages on this dimension, on this low slaveholding, high slaveholding dimension, the way that we really see develop postbellum. So it's in the postbellum period where you see these huge cleavages develop, kind of emerge in the data between places that were reliant on the institution of slavery versus places that weren't. And if you think about it, that actually makes a lot of sense, right? If I'm a white person who maybe aspired to slaveholding as a path to wealth accumulation, and all of a sudden that institution no longer existed, why would I support the interests of the former slaveholding areas? Right. I no longer have that incentive to support the oppression of African Americans and sort of these informal norms because I no longer can personally benefit from that. So it actually makes a bit of sense to us, especially in light of the work that's been done by historians and economists on these points. And we actually see this, I should add that we also see this really clearly in the data. So we see that these political cleavages were really like not quite there in the antebellum period. They really develop in the years leading up to the Civil War, and then boom, you know, in the years of Reconstruction and immediately following after, you see huge differences emerge between places that were former slaveholding places and places that were not. They just really diverge in terms of who they supported politically, the issues that were discussed, the votes that were taken kind of in this critical turn of the century period on these state constitutions that were all about black codes and things like that. That's when you see these real significant divergences in the postbellum period.
Now, Matt, these are, I think most would agree, really interesting findings, but also quite disturbing. I wonder if you could talk about, so you talk towards the end of the book about the things that the interventions that communities have tried, not all communities, but there have been national interventions, and to address these issues. This isn't all surprising. So have these interventions worked in the past? And, you know, is there any hope for future interventions, given one of the takeaways here is that that history is so important that we can't escape it simply by time? Is there hope in the book? Are there interventions that you look to that could address these things?
Yeah, I think there are two important points to hit with this on this point. You know, one is that one thing that is to make extremely clear here is that the kinds of relationships that we're finding are about the relative positions of people that live in the high slaveholding areas versus the low slaveholding areas. And so the relative alignment of who is more conservative and who is more liberal has been fairly persistent over the course of the late 19th and early 20th century. I think the one thing to note about that is that's not to say that racial attitudes have been fixed in place in these places. As a rule, America has gotten a lot more racially liberal. The South has also gotten more racially liberal. It's just that the people, as far as that we can measure, it's the relative alignment of those, the kind of persistence in the structure and the culture of those relationships has been pretty persistent. But it's surprising that that's the case when, as you said, there have been large federal interventions into Southern life that have really changed those relationships on other dimensions, right? So before things like the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, there were large disparities between the high slave South and the low slave South in terms of black-white wage gaps, about voting and registration for African Americans versus whites, about educational attainment in those areas. And across all of those things, what we find over the course of the 20th century, after some of these interventions like the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, we see that not only has there been a level shift so that, you know, the relative status of African Americans in the South has gotten better, but we also find an attenuation of the relationship between slavery and those things, right? So there's no, we no longer see a relationship between slavery and the black-white gap in education, or we see a much lower relationship with things like the wage gap, and certainly voting has gotten a lot, but changed almost overnight before and after the Voting Rights Act. So that really shows us that when the federal government can go in and actually do something, it actually tends to have a pretty big impact on these kinds of relationships. But I think for us, it's still, we don't see that same kind of attenuation on these attitudinal measures. And so I think it's an open question and something that I think should be explored in the future about, well, how can those things, will those things attenuate just over the long term? Are we just in a very slow radiation decay where things will just get more and more similar because of people moving and the natural kind of population overturn and things like that? Or will this kind of persist into the long term and we need other kinds of interventions to think about in terms of kind of getting it to a point where, at least on this dimension of kind of racial attitudes, America is a little bit more united in terms of how it views those issues.
Yeah. Again, the book is Deep Roots, How Slavery Still Shapes Southern Politics. The book is published by Princeton University Press. You've been hearing from the authors. Matt and Maya, thank you both very much. And Avi, thank you for your being the lead author as well. So thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah.